bars and there's 6 9 swing man. You can shoot the 3.
Urban Meyer?
Liar. Don't believe a word you said.
Look at you go.
Look at that. It's like seeing a kid ride a bike. And I'm going to law school, baby. It all starts here.
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Monday, October 12th, 2009. I'm your host, Adam Berry. Joining me today, three football writers fresh back from New Orleans and Baton Rouge. We got Mike DeFerdinando.
What's up, guys?
Kyle Maestri.
How's it going?
And Mike McCall.
I'm just excited to finally be talking about the big clash we've all been waiting for. And by that, of course, I mean my team defeating Ben Volans in the Alligator Sports College Football Fantasy League this weekend.
Really?
Took down the undefeated leader of the pack with the most points scored ever in our league in 1 week.
How many points?
178. Jaquizz Rodgers had 50 and Todd Reesing had 47, I think. It was totally unfair. And then Anthony Dixon had like 25.
Yeah, good week for you, though.
Yeah,
must be nice.
Yeah, I just made a huge mistake, though, because
Jonathan Phillips scored me 0 again.
You haven't dropped him yet?
No, I did.
Okay, that's good. All right, well, let's move on. Let's talk about what we're planning to talk about. We're obviously going to, you know, dive right into the LSU game. Let's talk about, I guess it's the biggest news. I wouldn't call it the story of the game, but it's certainly what got the spotlight and everything. Tim Tebow came out, started the game after suffering the concussion against Kentucky 2 weeks ago. Just talk about what Tebow did, how, you know, the game plan changed and everything like that against LSU.
It's hard to tell how much of the game plan changed because of Tebow. I mean, the thing that was very noticeable, I think Kyle took this stat. What was the stat of him keeping it on options in the first half?
3 out of 15.
That he kept the ball only 3 times out of 15, and that's definitely not what you normally see. Also, early on in the game, there was a 3rd and 1 where they handed off to Emmanuel Moody, and there was a 3rd and 3 where they handed it off to Jeff Demps, and then they had the 4th and 2 where they ran an end-around with Brandon James. And those are all, like, Tim Tebow runs for sure that they didn't use. So I think you saw them being a little careful with him there, and he said today at the press conference that he had to be patient with that. He kind of knew that would happen. They protect him a little bit. And then later in the game, they went to him more. But also, I mean, the whole game, Florida was way more rushing than passing, pretty conservative, but you don't know how much of that is because of Tebow and how much of it is because they knew they had a strong defense behind them. They didn't have to do anything crazy, and they might not have a great receiving core to work with anyway. So it's hard to tell which it was. You'll be able to get a clear picture of that probably this weekend against Arkansas.
Might not have a great receiving core?
Well, I don't know. I feel bad coming down on them when, like, they haven't really been asked to do anything. I mean, it's obvious that they're not super confident in them, and they probably shouldn't be, but I don't know. I'll wait until, like, they really fail. Like, because it's not like there's been a situation like Jordan Jefferson had late in the game where, like, he drops back and scans the field, everyone's just totally blanketed, and then he gets sacked. That doesn't happen that often. And when it does, Tebow still picks up, like, 10 yards, so who really cares? I mean, they haven't been in a situation yet where they've had to win a game with the passing game. So,
all right, what did the rest of you guys think of Tebow's performance? Definitely seemed a little more conservative than you usually see out of him.
Yeah, he shouldn't even played because he didn't play like Tebow, so what's the point? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we can all agree they played ridiculously conservatively in the first half and didn't use him at his full strength. So for me, that can only be for two reasons. One, you're concerned about his health when you don't want him to get hit, which I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that it wasn't that because Meyer said it wasn't that when I asked him about it. Or two, the fact that he's not at full strength as a player. Like, he can't do the things he normally does because he missed time, he missed practice, he's not in rhythm or stuff like that, which is what Meyer was saying led them to play so conservatively. But if that's the case, then just put Brantley out there. If he's the one who could have got all the reps, who could have been fine, good to go, just use him because it was ridiculous the way the offense was run. There was no balance in the passing to running game. If the receivers aren't actually that bad, then what, you don't have faith in Tebow to throw the ball? I don't really believe that. The receivers are probably pretty bad. But either way, maybe it was a little bit of both for this game, though. I don't know. But the whole thing is you have to find a way to at least pass the ball, throw some short passes, do something, because the offense is becoming predictable. And scoring 13 points should not be acceptable with the type of players that you have on that side of the ball.
I mean, they were definitely careful with Tebow in the first half. But, I mean, he still ended up with 17 carries, 38 yards. So even at like, hurt or not at his best, I guess 17 carries is a lot.
What is that? Is that good?
I don't think that's good.
2.2 yards carries.
Yeah, I don't think that's good at all. He ran the ball. He had the 1 like 8 yard scramble, and that was pretty impressive. But other than that, he really didn't do much running the ball. I mean, they gave the ball to Demps and stuff. They took a lot of the pressure off him. I'm not completely opposed to that, but I do agree with Kyle. If you were gonna do that, just play Brantley.
I disagree, and I don't think 13 points is unacceptable when you hold the other team to three. What's acceptable is scoring more points than the other team. Like, yeah, it's frustrating to see them frustrating to not see them be really explosive on offense, but they won the game, and they did what they had to do to win the game. And I haven't seen John Brantley do anything, and neither have you guys. So
I've watched him play from time to time whenever he trots out onto the field.
Yeah,
so.
But playing in Tiger Stadium against LSU is a totally different proposition. If they couldn't get the passing game going with what they had on Saturday night, why is Brantley going to be any different? It's not like there's going to be great balance between the passing and running game with John Brantley out there as opposed to Tebow. Tebow still made some good plays. He still picked up.
So if it's not Tebow, then what? Then it's the receivers, right?
Yeah, it probably is the receivers.
Okay, so so you're going to go back on what you said earlier. It is the receivers. That's why they're not passing the ball.
I said I'm trying to hold off like totally ripping them until I see them fail in a situation which they're trying.
What's the problem with the passing game? Is it Tebow or is it the receivers? It's somebody. It's not just this isn't how it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to throw the ball 16 times. So which is it? Is it the receivers or is it Tebow? Or is it both?
It's not Tebow.
Okay, so it's the receivers.
Yeah, but I'll wait until I see them fail. They haven't been asked to do anything, is what I'm saying. So I'm trying, like, yeah, they're not good.
There's the coaches. It could be the coaches also.
I don't have confidence in the receivers. I'm not saying that I do. I'm just saying I don't want to rip them as being garbage until I see them actually fail. But getting back, what was I just saying?
So then is it the coaches for you? Is it the coaching scheme that's bad?
I don't know. Can I not wait to make judgment? Like, is this not, like, is this totally, like, I can't wait to make a judgment on this?
How can you not make a judgment that the passing game was miserable for this game and almost non-existent?
It was miserable. It was non-existent. They didn't try to throw the ball.
So then why not try to fix that going forward so you don't lose to a team that's actually good and not just ranked number four because they narrowly won some early games?
I'm not saying they shouldn't try to fix the passing game.
Everything's fine. You went 13-3. That's fine. You're good. Don't be upset. The offense is cool. If you hold the team to 3 points, you outscored the other team, you're good. You did your job. Let's not say anyone needs to get better or fix anything, right?
They need to get better, and they need to be able to throw the ball more. It's a problem. You can't go through the whole season running the kind of offense they ran on Saturday, but they did what they had to do to win the game, so I'm not, like, furious at anyone.
All right, well, they obviously need to get better, but how do they get better? Are the pieces there, or are they just stuck with what they have?
I don't think they have any, like, huge playmaking receiver that's going to get anything done, and that's a problem.
I mean, is it time to go to some of the younger guys, like Amarius Hines, Frankie Ham, and TJ Lawrence, instead of David Nelson and Brandon James? I mean, did David Nelson play in the game Saturday? I mean, we were there. We saw him on the field. He didn't do anything.
He played, but they didn't throw to him. He also somehow graded out a champion this week.
Of course,
week. All the receivers graded out a champion. And Meyer also put some of it on the line. He said the line, like, he's not comfortable with, like, the blocking. I don't know. It's all crap. It's funny because in the spring he, like, ripped the receivers nonstop. Like, they don't understand that they have to get open and blah, blah, blah. He made all these comments about them, and now he's, like, backing off of it. I don't really understand why. And he also said that in the next 2 to 3 weeks they're going to have to make a call on Carl Moore, whether or not they're going to redshirt him and he'll be out for the year, or whether or not they're going to try and bring him back. I know Carl Moore's not great, but it's not like anyone else is. So, I mean, you want that body in there, someone who can play football.
I mean, does he affect? He wouldn't affect anything, I don't think.
If he came back healthy and was if he was, like, game ready, he'd be on the field.
Over who?
He'd get on the field. I mean, when Frankie Hammond's on the field, at least it'd be Carl Moore on the field. I think you'd see him out there. I mean, they still use, like, five people as wide receivers. They're just using Demps and Rainey right now
You're better off with Carl Moore than you are with Brandon James.
Well, yeah. I agree with that, yeah.
I mean, Carl Moore had an entire season where he got to start and did pretty much nothing. So I don't think Carl Moore is really the solution to anything. Like, if you say that we don't get to see Brantley play, we saw Carl Moore play for an entire year, and he really didn't do anything as far as I'm concerned. So, I don't know, whatever. He'd be another, number four receiver that's forced to actually play a meaningful role on this team that can't step up and can't make plays. And I think what it is the coaching staff knows their receivers are bad, and they don't call plays for them. So, they need to make some kind of a switch. They need to get whoever it is ready to play a wide receiver. They need to adapt the way they use their wide receivers, get some faster guys on the field, throw screen passes, do something to spread the field out. But when you can just clog the box and half your plays are just dives up the middle where there's no other thing going on in your offense, and you're not making the defense guard from sideline to sideline, which is what the spread is supposed to do. If you listen to Dan Mullen talk in media day, want to spread them out, make them cover the whole field sideline to sideline, get our guys in one-on-one situations. That's not what they're doing. The play calling is terrible, and to have 16 passes in an entire game is ridiculous.
So why would you play Brantley then? Why would you have played him when he can't run? He's just going to be throwing the ball to the receivers that you're so down on.
I would have played Brantley because I think that you would have been able to do more with him than they did with Tebow. I think if you're just going
to... What are you talking about? Like, Tebow runs, Brantley doesn't. They don't have people to throw to, so why would you have someone...
Tebow didn't run in the first half. He did not. He ran the ball like 4 times in the first half or something like that.
He still picked up first downs running and had...
No, like, he didn't in the first half.
I'm talking about the whole game. They played 4 quarters.
I understand that, Mike, but for the first 2 quarters, they didn't run Tebow and they didn't pass with Tebow. They did nothing with Tebow. Okay. Literally nothing. He threw 6 passes and ran the ball like 4 times. He handed it off to the running backs every time. I think you can throw the ball more times than 6 with John Brantley. He could probably run more times than 4. So for 2 quarters, 30 minutes, you wasted that entire first half to score points.
Okay, that's a play calling issue. So what, you would play Brantley for the first half and then Tebow for the... I don't understand what you're
No,
saying.
I would play Brantley the whole time if that's how I'm going to use him, so I don't throw away 30 minutes of game time to score points and move the ball.
Okay, I don't see what Brantley could have done better is my problem.
They could have used him. He could have been a player on the field instead of just handing the ball off.
They could have used Tebow more, too. I mean,
that's fine. Then use Tebow more. Okay, I agree. They could have used Tebow more. They should have used Tebow more. But if you're going to do what you did with him for whatever reason that you're concerned, put in Brantley instead.
Like, if you're going to play Tebow, use him like Tebow. But if you're going to use Tebow like Brantley, play Brantley, I think is the argument.
Yes,
but
that's exactly the argument.
I can't imagine them playing Brantley and using him to the fullest of his capacity. Like, that doesn't make, like...
But if you're going to use Tebow...
His first start, you're going to throw him in Tiger Stadium, have him airing the ball out. Like, and he's not going
to be running
either, though. Right, I know. But I'm saying they would play Brantley much the same way they play Tebow. Honestly, if Brantley played against LSU, he'd be doing a whole lot of handing off. A whole lot of handing off. And a whole lot of throwing to Aaron Hernandez, which is the same thing Tebow did. So I'd take my chances with the guy who's proven and the guy who can still make some plays with his legs. I'm not saying Brantley can't run. I actually think Brantley's a decent runner. He just doesn't like to.
Mm.
Kind of like Chris Leake.
Okay.
So he didn't make plays with his legs, though, the first half. He didn't. He handed the ball off every time, pretty much every time, and they never ran him on short yard situations.
I wasn't happy with the first half play calling either, but I'm talking about the whole game, and I think overall you're better off with Tebow playing than with Brantley.
I think you're better off with Tebow playing than with Brantley if you're going to let him play, but they didn't let him play.
I can't imagine them letting Brantley play.
I think that, okay, fine.
I think
you should let whoever goes out there play. You shouldn't handcuff whoever you put out there.
I would take, if you're going to put Brantley out there and let him throw and have confidence in him throwing and open up the offense, I'd take that over Tebow not doing anything but handoff, for sure. I can't imagine them doing that with Brantley. His first time in a meaningful situation is at LSU. The players said after the game, and they told Meyer, that's the loudest, toughest environment they've ever been in. And I don't know why you would trust Brantley.
Because John Brantley's the next guy in line. He's a real quarterback, supposedly. You got to give him if you're going to have somebody go out there who's going to take away the quarterback position for you, where he's literally just the go-between the center and the running back, just get someone out there. Let John Brantley throw short passes. I'm not saying drop back and throw the ball 50 yards downfield every time, but let him at least move the ball a little bit, have the ball come out quick on 3-step drops, do something different. Run a little eye for him if you want, but just have some sort of semblance on offense.
Do you not think the threat of Tebow out there made any difference? I know he didn't do much in the first half, but I mean, the linebackers still have to be aware of him. They still have to keep an eye on him.
I don't think there's any threat. I think he just literally, like, it just looked like he wasn't in it. It looked like nothing was going on.
I think the running backs, any one of the three, would be more effective running threats than Tebow was in the game.
But I mean, as far as what the defense has to think about and account for, they still have to account for Tebow and pay attention for where he is and his running threat.
But they didn't put him in a position to do that. Like, they weren't even running options off the edge for the most part. They ran like 2 or 3 of those, but most of it was just catch the ball, put the ball in the running back's belly, and let him go.
Let's talk about the running backs then. We expected them to get more carries. Ironically, Tebow ended up with the 17 carries anyway, so the distribution wasn't quite what we expected. Tebow's carries didn't necessarily go to anyone extra except in the first half, you know, when the guys kind of spread it out a little bit. What did you see out of the three of them? Moody, I'm assuming, didn't get as much as you'd like him to? Or?
No, I would have given Moody the ball more. Jeff Demps, 16 carries, 86 yards. He had a 25-yard run that he broke off pretty early, I think. 5.4 yards per carry. I believe he is now, was he first last week or what? I think he's now first in the nation in yards per carry. I think he was like second or third last week. So, and then Moody, 6 carries, 42 yards. That's average of 7 per carry. And then Rainey, 4 carries for 11 yards. Didn't have a good game at all. But talking about the way they were used, I mean, Dempson Rainey up the middle against a defense like LSU's that's stacking for the run is a bad decision to me. Like Dempse's good runs came on the outside where he could get outside and make people miss. And Rainey's the same way. They're the same like kind of running back where you want to get them in space where they can make people miss one-on-one. And Moody, ran up the middle just about every time and did really well. So that's how I would use those three guys.
I agree with you for the most part about Demps, but I think you're totally wrong in this game. I think all of his good runs came like up the middle off tackle where he was able to bust it outside eventually. I actually thought he struggled to get the corner on a lot of plays. There were a lot of plays where he just missed getting the corner and got taken down, or like they kind of ran him down on the outside and he wasn't able to ever get up the sideline once he bounced it outside initially. You saw a lot of plays where he hit the hole in between the guard and the tackle and then bounced it outside after that. But I didn't see any plays where they pitched it out to him and he turned the corner on the LSU defense.
He definitely turned the corner one time. I think it was like a 12-yard run where he took it outside. It was an option pitch that he took around the corner. And then, yeah, his 25-yard run was off tackle. But I'm talking about like the one straight up the gut where they were just getting hit at the line and dropped. And that never happened to Moody. It almost never happens to Moody. And that's, I would give him those carries if you're not going to give him to Tebow.
Well, the thing about running Demps outside against LSU is LSU's, what, probably the fastest defense Florida will see all year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the limit of his potential against LSU. You know, try to run outside. You got linebackers who can actually catch you, which is the difference, I guess. Which is why Moody was more effective up the middle. And, you know, you can get Demps bouncing off tackle, just sort of, you know, force blocking schemes up the middle that they usually wouldn't do and that they usually wouldn't work against other teams. So.
And, I mean, the running backs are definitely the strongest part of this team offensively outside of Tebow. I mean, the receivers obviously aren't getting anything done. So at some point, do you just decide, okay, we're a running team, we're going to run the ball and just forget about the passing game for the most part?
They've already decided that. I mean, I think like 70% of their plays this year have been running. Like, they are a running team. They have been a running team in the past for the most part. I mean,
do you even have to throw the ball then? If the running backs are this good and Tebow can run and Demps can run and Moody and Rainey, do you need to throw the ball all the time?
You can't be one-dimensional. Like, you still have to have a threat. Like, Deontay and Riley Cooper are going to have to stretch the field a little bit. Like, there has to be a threat of the passing game. Aaron Hernandez is still going to get his catches. Aaron Hernandez is good, and you can rely on him to get – I mean, he had 6 catches for 70 yards. He was really good on Saturday. He also was involved, you know, the little shovel pass, and he even took an option pitch.
Yeah.
He might have even taken a handoff at one point. No, he didn't.
No, just the pitch.
But, I mean, Hernandez is a threat, and you have to have a threat of a passing game. You have to keep defenses honest.
Yeah, you can't just completely abandon the pass. And you have a good quarterback who can throw – you have 2 good quarterbacks who can throw the ball. I mean, it's going to be Tebow for the rest of the year, and he can throw the ball fine. But, it's either the receivers or the play calling or something, but – if you look, Tebow's shown that he can throw the ball. It's not like last year he threw the ball fine. He had good receivers. I think Lewis Murphy was better than we all thought.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they didn't recruit well. They let too many guys transfer. I don't know what the deal is, but to me it's on the coaches to fix this thing. Either put some guys out there who are hungry to make some plays or just switch up the way you're using guys. Urban Meyer is supposedly legendary, and he is. He's done a good job. Use the guy's talents that you have to make everything work within the offense, and that's not happening right now. David Nelson's doing literally nothing out there. He's literally doing nothing. He blocks running plays. That's all he does. He catches one ball a game, maybe, if he's lucky. I didn't even see him on Saturday because he made no impact on the offense whatsoever. Deontay Thompson, 2 catches for 11 yards.
Okay.
Like, Riley Cooper had 1 big play. Good. Thank you. Threw the ball downfield to him. Like, just figure out a way to get these guys involved in the offense.
Oh, on the interception to Cooper in the fourth quarter, Tebow talked about that today. It was Tebow's fault. He said he was everything else was covered, and then he looked down the field and saw Cooper running the fly route, and he kind of had pressure. He was getting chased, and he said he thought Cooper was going to stop because whenever he's scrambling, he says him and Cooper normally do that. Like, it's not like written into the playbook or anything, but he just normally does it.
Mm-hmm.
So he threw the pass hoping Cooper would stop, but he kept running, and he said, you know, he should have really just thrown the ball away, but he could have put it up, you know, for Cooper in the end zone, too, and might have had a shot at that. I mean, Cooper had the guy deep.
Right.
It would have had to be a real well-thrown ball on the run, running to the right also, but he should have probably thrown it away or at least put it up deep, but that wasn't Cooper's fault, unlike many we've seen in the past.
Yeah, I couldn't tell what the deal with that was because at that point they had the lead. I figured it was you were going to see 3 straight runs, you know, clock it out, run it up on the ground,
What they really wanted were a couple routes over the middle that were blanketed. And also, I believe the safety valve, like whatever running back they had out in the flat, was covered too.
Mm.
So the whole thing was pretty much shut down, and then he had to take off.
Mm. All right, well, with the slamming on the offense pretty much over, let's talk about the unit that impressed us more than I think I even expected. The defense was incredible Saturday. Held them with 3 points. The defense special teams touchdown ratio to opposing offense still tied at 2-2. They've been incredible. They were great. Brandon Spikes was as good as I've ever seen him or any linebacker at Florida play on Saturday.
Yeah, defense was absolutely incredible. That like we've been saying, that's the reason why this team is so good, and you can have a lot of confidence in them just go out and win every week. It's because if the offense has a game like they had, they're still going to go out there and win the game for you. And they just did a really impressive job. Brandon Spikes looked healthy to me for the first time in a couple weeks. He was just making explosive plays. He was closing out on people finally. He was getting to the quarterback. He was wreaking havoc all over the field. The defensive backs were smothering the wide receivers. The only long pass play they had was on Marquis Anderson, who's their third corner. So it was just really an impressive showing for the defense.
Yeah, the corners played incredible. Hayden and Janoris Jenkins were out of control. Brandon LaFell and Terrence Tolliver, LSU's two big receivers, really good. Combined for, 58 yards, and 26 of those came on Marquis Anderson. So they really shut those guys down. And the whole secondary played great, I thought. And even, Will Hill said after the game that they knew Jordan Jefferson locked down on one target, and that if they could take, if they could blanket the two big receivers, that they'd pretty much have it shut down. And, yeah, Spikes, I thought, not only that, part of Spikes' game is that he kind of, wanders around, and he'll make plays all over the field, maybe not necessarily exactly where he's supposed to be. But I thought he did a much better job of, staying focused where he needed to be, because some of the earlier games this year, I thought he was, out of position a few times. He even made some, lazy attempts at tackles against, Tennessee, I believe. Hmm. And this was a totally different Brandon Spikes, really motivated and focused. And when he plays like that, I mean, the whole defense feeds off of Spikes. They always say that. When he plays like that, I can't imagine anything going wrong.
I think it was just the game. They knew they had to step up in this game, playing against a good defense, offense, question marks coming in with Tebow and everything. Was it sort of just their game to step up, or can we expect this for the rest of the year?
I mean, the atmosphere and the spotlight on that game was enormous, and I think that plays something to do with it. Also, I mean, you got to imagine they were really confident going up against that offense, the 12th best offense in the SEC for total offense. I mean, I think that feeds into it a little bit, and it's a rivalry game, a big rivalry game with really high stakes, so that defense always finds something to get ticked off about before every game. I mean, they're still talking about the 2007 game afterward a little bit. I mean, they always find something to get a chip on their shoulder about.
And what's the deal? Kirk Herbstreit on ESPN College Game Day before supposedly called out Brandon Spikes and I think Carlos Dunlap, saying that he really needed to step up on this. They'll go out of their way to find stuff to get pumped up about and get ticked off about.
They had a quote in their hotel before the Kentucky game from Alfonso Smith about how they were fast but not physical or something that they were upset about. I mean, they go looking for this stuff. They really go hunting for it. And Meyer said today, please keep doing it. Call out Spikes, call out Dunlap, and call out Tebow. Keep it coming, because they have to use that every week.
The Herbstreit thing's ridiculous. So I'm pretty sure the context of it was Tebow's out, so the defense, they're going to need you guys. You need to step up. It wasn't you guys are bad and you need to do better for your team to win. So, whatever they need to use, I guess.
I don't think it was a situation where it was he's been playing poorly this year. That Brandon Spikes guy, he's finally got to show me something here.
Yeah, exactly. They don't worry about context.
They just find, Alfonso Smith. They just find whatever quote works, put it up on a wall.
I haven't even been able to find that. Did anybody, I went looking for it after the game because Ryan Samper was talking about it so much. I mean, at what point are they just making this stuff up? We got nothing Saturday morning. Alfonso Smith will be good. We'll pick him. Let's type something up.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about the return game, something one of you guys brought to my attention about. I think there was, what was the deal with the one touchback, one possible return? It was kicked out of the end zone for a touchback. Both kickers, not letting return men do anything on Saturday.
I think Trenton Holiday and Brandon James combined for 41 return yards.
Okay.
And they were both on kickoffs. They didn't, Florida... Did Trenton Holiday return a punt? I don't think he did.
They only punted one time, and Chaz Henry shanked it, no.
Yeah, and LSU had one punt downed at, the 7. He shanked one out of bounds for 16 yards, which, even though Brandon James doesn't touch the ball, he affects that play. I mean, that's pretty. That works out pretty well for Florida. And then, let's see, they had the other one that he fair caught. And I know it looks weird when he makes these fair catches when he has a lot of room, but Meyer said today that if they put the punt block on, if they're going after the punter, that Brandon James is pretty much under orders to make a fair catch if it's a high punt. If it's a line drive, he takes his chances because he's got his eyes more focused, but he doesn't really have blockers, so he's going to fair catch it when they go for a block.
But he's not getting kicked to anymore, essentially. Do they change anything, or do they just focus more on the block? Where do they go from here?
I think they focus on the block. I mean, if he gets the ball back there to return, he will. He'll get a chance to, but they're not going to kick it to him, so they're better off just focusing on the block.
I feel like the rate of touchdowns Brandon James would score on a punt return is probably not as good as the rate of kicks they would block if they really went after it. I don't know how you guys feel about that. Their punt block unit's pretty scary to me.
Well, they've been trying to block punts this year, and they haven't gotten any, so I don't know. I mean, in the past, last year was insane.
Rainy.
They just blocked. Yeah, Rainey blocked one. So I think one block out of five games isn't too ridiculous. Last year was insane, though. So I don't know. And I feel like they're using it more this year than they did last year. So I don't know if teams are more prepared for it. I think the strategy is just, like, bunker down and kick it out of bounds 30 yards downfield. I don't know. But I'm kind of surprised they haven't got more pressure on their punt block unit.
I mean, it kind of doesn't matter because either way, they're either going to probably get after one or get close to getting one, and they'll have, you know, a shorter punt, or Brandon's going to get the ball and he's going to have a pretty good return. So they're safe either way.
One other thing on the punt return, you mentioned Holiday not returning. Have they allowed a punt return yard all year? I feel like I can't remember anybody returning a punt on Florida. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd have to look at it.
I mean, since none of the games have been, like, super nail-biting, I mean, even this weekend, you kind of knew LSU wasn't going to score enough points to win, so it was kind of, like, anticlimactic. I mean, for me, the crowd noise made it a little different, but, like, I knew LSU wasn't going to, like, march down the field, really. Mm. So I guess that kind of takes it out of noticing things like that. Like, I wouldn't notice a long punt return if I know it probably doesn't matter. So I don't know.
All right, well, one other thing about the game I want to talk about is we all saw this before the game started. Florida was super amped up for this game. They were jumping around the field. They actually started jumping all over the Eye of the Tiger, like, logo at midfield before the game. The LSU players came out. There was, like, almost a near brawl before it was broken up.
They did that in 2007, too, and a lot of these games have that happen. And it's almost like, I mean, it's never really dangerous. Like, it's always, it's like a planned thing, almost. Like, they do it all the time in these games. I think they should do it every week. Like, I think it's a good, like, get the game started, like, get the crowd into it moment. That's not really, like, violent. There's not really, like, a threat of it. Although, Jermaine Cunningham was toeing the line a little bit. He, like, took his helmet off. He was, like, making all these gestures and, like, getting up in their face about it. But, I mean, I don't know. It's not, like, too dangerous. It's pretty cool. I think they should do it every week.
We talked about this before, but intentional on the eye, because that's something they're, like, you know, careful about.
I didn't really think so. Like, that's the same position in the field where Florida huddles up and jumps around every week. So, I mean, I'm sure someone did it. Like, no doubt about it, someone stomped on the eye on purpose. Yeah. But I don't think it was, like, a team-wide, like, we're going to jump on their logo thing.
It was definitely a team-wide, they're going to jump on their logo thing. You have 50 yards of field where you can huddle wherever you want.
And they huddle there every single
time.
That's a huge logo. They were all, like, 45.
You know how important this is to the other team. Like, the eye is, like, this huge thing at LSU. You don't do that on accident. And then it wasn't, like, a reaction of, okay, our bad, let's get off the eye. It was, like, let's fight about it, pretty much, from there. So I find it really hard to believe that this was just some big coincidence. And I also think it's a bad idea for them to do stuff like if you want to huddle and jump around on the 30-yard line, that's fine. It's up to you. But I think it's a really bad idea to do that on midfield because only bad's going to come of that. It's not like they need that to get hyped up. But if somebody throws a punch and gets kicked out before the game even starts, like, why even risk something like that?
And the funniest part about all of this is, like, 5 minutes before this happened on the Jumbotron, one of the players was giving an interview, and he was talking about, like, we don't let anyone jump on the eye. No one touches
the eye. Yeah, exactly.
No one touches the eye.
Yeah, I remember hearing that, and then they went out there and jumped on the eye. So, like, they knew what they were doing. Yeah.
They do this all the time. I don't really think it's, like, a pre-plan, we're going to jump on their logo thing. I don't buy that. I don't think they care that much about it.
I mean, maybe they didn't come in saying, let's jump on the eye, but once they got there, they're like, you know, they hear somebody saying nobody jumps on the eye.
Yeah.
They're in the stadium like, yeah, nobody jumps on the eye. We're going to jump on the eye.
Right.
Like, that's kind of how they think. It helps them get pumped up. It helps get that vitriol that they like from the opposing team. If they can't get quotes from somewhere, they're going to just get mad at them.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, yeah, well, they disrespected us before the game. Nobody believed in us.
Either way, intentional or just doing what they do every week, I think they just keep doing it. Like, I like it a lot. I think it's a good kick. It's a good way to kick off the game for me.
And you should say they keep doing it. They won't because it's becoming like an image thing. Like, you don't want to be the team who goes in and disrespects.
I mean, they'll probably do it for Georgia. Like, they've done it with Georgia in the past, like, where they all kind of meet at midfield and jump around and look at each other and, like, bark at each other. So
nobody jumps on Jacksonville Municipal Stadium.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, that's not nearly the big deal.
My point is, it's not about the logo to me. It's just about, like, they're at midfield looking at each other, like, jumping around. Like, they always huddle there and jump up and down, and now the other team's there, and they just do it at each other for a while. Like,
it's just,
they do it all the time.
I don't know. I just don't think that's smart. It only takes, like, one comment from somebody to push somebody over the edge, and then all of a sudden there's fighting. So.
And the Garrett Blunt breaks out.
Which is the beauty of it all.
Deaver loves the anarchy.
I want chaos. I want, like, this on the edge, like, maybe something's going to happen.
If you can get Brandon LaFell to hit you and get him ejected,
absolutely.
Great.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's exactly their attitude. Brandon LaFell punched him in the face, and he just puts his arms up and said, he hit me, throw him out. That's exactly what would happen.
Carlos Dunlap.
There's no way they would exchange blows there. He'd just walk away and be the bigger man.
Here's
the
strategy. You get one of the guys that's probably not going to play to throw the first punt, right? So you get, like, some scrubby guy to throw the first punt, and then it just goes, and it's on. And then you hope one of the better players from the other team hits back.
I'm for that.
You mean, like, get David Nelson in there?
sounds like a job for Okine.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, Earl Okine goes in, throws the first punch. He's not going to play anyway.
He's the hitman.
Yeah. That's a great nickname for Earl Okine.
He's imposing enough where, like, the other team feels like they have to react to him. It's not like Joey Sorrentino runs in there and throws a punch where they just kind of gently, like, move him to the ground.
So. I say you get David Nelson. Team captain, let's be honest, he's irrelevant at this point.
I can't picture David Nelson doing a punch.
No, he wouldn't.
In any circumstance.
No, I don't think so either. But, I mean, he's irrelevant as well at this point.
He's gotten some personal foul penalties in the past, like where he hit somebody on the field. Yeah, like it was one of those things where they're like blocking each other and like shoving, and then he like kind of pops him in like the like under the chin, kind of. Yeah, that. No, I think he's got a little bit of a mean streak.
He's showing that feistiness.
I think in a brawl he'd be heading for the tunnel. See,
if we actually like put bets on who I think would actually throw a punch, my money's on Riley Cooper. I think he's definitely throwing the first punch.
I mean, if you want to talk like penalties, that like personal foul penalties or uncalled personal fouls, I think he's up there.
I don't know. I think they could all be capable in the right situation, which is why I say don't do that at the beginning of the game.
Now, was Tebow in there jumping around?
The whole team is jumping around, but there's just like one half of the huddle is on the logo. I mean, it's literally, watch them every week. They jump in the same spot. It's just half the huddle. It's on the logo because LSU has an enormous, gaudy midfield logo.
Yeah, but you're acting like they didn't know. They knew.
Yeah, they knew. Chaz Henry was awesome in that, by the way. Chaz Henry, his helmet was in his hand. He was pumping up the crowd. He was jumping up and down with, like, all the defensive backs, like, going absolutely insane. It was sweet.
Chaz Henry knew he was due for a big game. Had to get pumped up for it.
Absolutely. He had to get ready for his one punt. So.
Well, he was the third-string quarterback this week.
Oh, so. That's right.
One more thing about the game, though, transitioning from our brawl talk. I thought that, you know, you said that Urban Meyer said multiple times that he played conservatively because the defense was playing so well. But I really felt like they played like they were the worst team. Like, they went out there with the strategy of, we need to shorten this game as much as possible. We just want to get in and get out. Like, we're going to lean on the defense. But to me, I just felt like their play calling was so conservative. And there was, especially on 4th-and-1 from the LSU 39-yard line, instead of going for it, they were only up, I think, 7 points at this point, or it could have been 10, but either way, it was not a lot of points. Mm-hmm. And instead of going for it, Tebow goes out there, tries to draw the other team offsides. They fail. He takes the delayed game penalty to give Chaz Henry some more room, and then they punt the ball. And Chaz Henry, like, shanks it anyway, so you probably picked up 20 or 25 yards there. But, I mean, you can't account for that. But if the defense is playing so well, I think that's why you go for it there. Because if you turn it over on the 39-yard line, okay, you have faith in your defense that they're going to stop them, but you can knock them out right there. And if you let teams hang around, it only takes one bad play, one thing gone wrong to get them back in the game and change the momentum. So if you're up 7 there and Tebow throws a pick and they take it back to the house, or it's a fumble and it changes their momentum, all of a sudden you let one play swing the game instead of just playing how you would normally play and lengthening the game.
Do you think he had so little confidence in his offense, though, that changed it? Or do you think it was just he had, but I don't know, more confidence in LSU's?
He talked about that today, and he said, I agree with Kyle on this, but he said the opposite of what Kyle just said.
Right.
That, like,
the opposite thinking, which is not true, I don't think.
They would, like, in the past, they'd go for it because, like, they knew their defense wasn't going to stop them anyway. But now they punt it because they know no one can go, like, 95 yards on this defense or whatever. That was what he said today.
But can anybody go, like, 61 yards or whatever on
the
defense?
To me, it's reverse. Like, he's thinking in reverse. I don't think he actually believes this, by the way. I think he's just saying it to the media. But it's reverse thinking. If you have confidence in your defense, you don't need to try to pin them down on the 5-yard line. You can trot them out there at the 4, like, when the team only has 60 yards to go, and they're going to do the same job for you. But you can't let teams hang around like that. That will bite them. If they play like this more than once down the stretch of the season, that will bite them in the butt, because one bad play, one special teams play gone wrong, and all of a sudden it's a totally different game. Whereas if you just play your game and you're trying to put up points, you can recover from one bad play.
All right, how much of that do you think is Tebow-related on Meyer's part? Because Tebow's long been the Urban Meyer crutch when things get bad. Just get the ball to Tim, he's going to get it done no matter what. So do you think the fact that Tebow was not at his best, and maybe Urban's weighing on Urban's mind, that he's like, all right, we're going to play a little more conservatively because Tim can't bail us out this time?
I guess, but I mean, you could do something different. If you really don't want to go with Tebow, which I would have ran the ball with Tebow right up the middle like I've done for the last 3 years if I'm Urban Meyer. But if not, hand it off to Moody, hand it off to somebody else. It's 1 yard. Like, you can do something there where it's not like Tebow takes on 3 defenders and you know, has to barrel his way through a couple linebackers. If anything, you know, supposedly they have an under center package that Tebow can run. We see him do it every once in a while. Get up under there and then just have him fall forward, like, instead of getting a full head of steam crashing into people. But there's no reason to punt that ball.
tell you what I would not do in a fourth and short situation, run a reverse to Brandon James.
Right. That was bad. That was a terrible call. You got to give it to Tebow there. And I think you got to give it to Tebow on that fourth and one also.
Right.
Although I don't totally hate the punt decision if Chaz Henry hits it a little better, which I think you normally would be pretty confident in Chaz Henry. But, I mean, I would run with Tebow first above all else in a 2 yards or less situation at any point in any game.
Right.
But I also don't think it's that much cause for concern. Like, this game, like, this is the worst situation I think they're going to be in all year. Tebow not being fully healthy and in that environment. That environment is huge. That environment alone probably was like a 2-touchdown swing in this game. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so I don't think, no matter who they play for the rest of the year, they'll play better competition than LSU if they face Alabama or Texas, USC, whoever in the championship games. But that atmosphere, they'll never have to deal with anything like that for the rest of the year. Unless Starkville is way sweeter than I thought.
I agree with Mike that, like, Chaz Henry, you do have faith in Chaz Henry. Obviously, he's a really good punter. That's not why I wouldn't punt it to keep the ball away from him. But I just think I think at the 39-yard line, you need to go for it. That's just something that, like, they would always do normally. And Urban Meyer said after the game, too, talking about the reverse play, that 2 yards is a little bit long for Tim. Like, that, well, we didn't do it because 2 yards is a little bit long. Anybody who's watched the Gators play knows it's just BS. Like, it's just lie right to my face. Go ahead. Like, just be honest every once in a while. Like, we've seen Tebow run it against Tennessee. It was 3rd and 3s and 4th and 3s. It wasn't 2. It was an extra yard, and they were still pounding him up the middle and getting first down. So, I mean, it's ridiculous. Just own up to it. Say we didn't feel comfortable with Tim today, so we felt like we had to do something like that. But everything goes according to plan at all times with the Gators.
Tebow kind of alluded to that today and said, like, he was kind of expecting them to be careful with him in the game.
Right.
And that's definitely what it was. I mean, they're just watching it with Tebow. But the thing, too, is, like, they still used him in those situations a couple times later on in the game. Like,
right.
Yeah. So I don't get, like,
I think the coaches needed a gut check. I don't think it was Tebow. I think Tebow would have been okay going out there the first play and putting his head down. But I think the coaches needed to watch him, like, play for a little bit before they had confidence enough in him to, like, start running him and start using him as they normally would, and that was a mistake. I mean,
to me, when he gets hit, like, straight on in the chest the first time, his head hits the turf, he still completes the pass, he gets up and he's fine.
Right.
That's the message that it's okay. I mean, they were giving him concussion tests throughout the game on the sideline.
Right.
Like, they were really conscious of him the whole time.
Yeah, I think the coaches were just way too conservative in their thinking.
All right, one thing we mentioned quite a bit before that we want to kind of expound upon here is the atmosphere in Tiger Stadium and, you know, in Baton Rouge and even in New Orleans, just the atmosphere surrounding this game. Can you guys just talk about that? Start with Tiger Stadium before the game.
Well, I loved it. I know, McCall, you had been there before. Me and Kyle had never.
Kyle,
you've been as a fan. I had never been there at all. I was blown away by the atmosphere at Tiger Stadium, especially before the game. Before the game, it was, like, electric. It was, like, unlike anything I'd ever been around before. The fans were going crazy. The student section was filled in, like, hours before the game because of the way they do their seating. The band is literally in the student section.
Yeah,
not cool. In the bottom, but, like, up in the middle of the student section. So when you're driving down in that end zone and the fans and the band are there, it's unbelievable. I loved it.
Yeah, their student section, you get a ticket, and then to get a good seat, you got to get there first. Like, it's first come, first serve. So they open gates at, like, 4:15, which was 2 hours and 45 minutes before kickoff. So it was pretty wild in there beforehand. Like, I mean, I know I was standing down on the field, like, an hour and 45 minutes before kickoff, and there was almost no seats left in the student section, and they were just going insane. Like, Les Miles randomly walked out to do something, and they just went insane. Like, some Florida players came out and stretched. They were all over him. Some random Florida student, was sitting in the LSU student section, and she was catching nothing but hell from them. The cops had to come down and, like, settle things down. And for the second – all right, so 3 LSU games in a row that I have, like, pretty clear in my mind, when – like, those games, like, you feel like you're at the center of the world. Like, nothing else is going on that's more important anywhere else. And for whatever reason, I get that feeling more. Like, the lights seem like they're more on, like, you're more in the spotlight at LSU for some reason. I love the Swamp. I like the Swamp better as a stadium. And I think it still gets louder at its peak points just because of the way that it's built. So, I mean, zero disrespect to the Swamp. But, like, Tiger Stadium is just different to me. It seems more big time. And there's more, like, celebrities randomly hanging around, which was kind of odd. We were in the elevator with a guy who was on Desperate Housewives. Cuba Gooding Jr. supposedly was there. Lil Wayne and Shaq were there.
James Carville. I
mean, yeah, James Carville's always there. And you know, last time we were there, like, Rick Riley just showed up in the press box drunk. He wasn't there to cover the game. Like, I don't know. People just come out of the woodwork for that game. And it's really awesome. Like, I totally recommend going to a game at LSU for that. But, I mean, it's not like they don't have their problems in other games. Like, this was the team coming to town and the player coming to town, and all the circumstances surrounding it made it a huge deal. And I picked up their student newspaper and read it from the week before, and they had all these columns about, like, let's not all get blackout drunk and not know what's going on. Like, let's actually get there early and make it a cool experience inside the stadium. So it's not like this is an every week thing there. But for this being the huge event that it was amazing.
I love the column saying, let's not get blackout. Like, guys, let's not do what we usually do here. Yeah. Let's be football fans this time around.
I want to talk about the blackout drunk thing. Because, all right, maybe this isn't how they always are. Maybe they do get blackout drunk. But I was going to say that the LSU fans seem to be more involved and more focused on the football game itself than they were. There was tailgating. The tailgating was great and it was huge and stuff. But they seem to be way more focused on the game and the players and stuff than maybe the Florida fans
It was different in 2007. In 2007, it was like, we're all so hammered that we're just going to react to other loud noises and like big things happening. Because for the first three quarters of that game, when Florida took them out of it pretty much by taking an early lead, there wasn't that much going on. It wasn't very impressive at all. And then the fourth quarter, it just got totally insane because I think their buzz was wearing off, and then LSU was coming back. This game did seem different to me. Like, the whole game, it was crazy intense in there. Like, it was insane. I've never seen anything with a play-to-play intensity like that. The Swamp's still awesome, and the Swamp still has games like that, but this was another level to me. And also, I mean, this is the biggest matchup in a long time. I mean, right. The Swamp hasn't had anything like this since I've been here.
Right. That's the thing I think we need to keep in mind here. The atmosphere is incredible, and I love going to the game as a fan 2 years ago. I love going to the game this time. I was telling D-Fur, me and Bobby were on the way, and it's absolutely incredible, and it's very different from the Swamp, but I think they're both pretty much the same. Like, there's no reason to pick one. They're both so awesome as environments that, like, it doesn't really matter who's better than who. But the last two times we've been there, the number one team has played. Like, one time it was LSU, one time it was Florida, and then the other team was in the top 10 both times. So these were much bigger games than the last couple times we've seen LSU come into the Swamp and play. And also, like, when's the last time? I mean, the Ole Miss game, I think the fans were really good. Then you're kind of getting, you know, kicked in the groin there. So there were times where they hushed. Ole Miss was able to silence the crowd, I'm sure. But also the South Carolina game was probably the last close game before that that they won. And I thought that the fans were awesome. That was probably the best atmosphere I've ever been in, like, sitting in the stands. It's close between that and 2007 LSU Florida. So I don't know. I think they're both just incredible environments. And I'm definitely not buying into the LSU fans are more astute than Gator fans and they're less drunk and stuff. It's all pretty much the same fan base.
I think they're more drunk. no, I really like that. Like, all right, the whole atmosphere we saw around Baton Rouge and in New Orleans, like, things are just different there.
That's
martial law.
It's looser in Louisiana, like, for sure. It's Louisiana, and I think that carries over into the students and into the student section for sure. I mean, they're intense. Like, they're still really intense, but I think there might be a little more drinking going on in Baton Rouge than in Gainesville when it comes to the student section.
I sort of point out that LSU fans had the coolest Bud Light games. They had the purple and gold, like, team color, yeah, Bud Light games that were outlawed here.
Yeah,
they're
supposed to be outlawed everywhere pretty soon. I don't know how that's kept up.
Like you said, Louisiana's just different, you know?
Yeah.
They have fun.
No, like, laws don't apply. Like, what? All right, so we were walking around. This is legal, so I'm going to say it. I had a water bottle full of Jameson whiskey in my pocket when we were in New Orleans, and I'm walking around with it, and I'm, like, conscious of it the whole time. Like, it's in my pocket. I need to make sure it stays in my pocket. Like, don't pull this out. Like, I don't want to get in trouble. Like, this can't happen to me. Like, I don't ever drink anyway, so, like, I don't want to get in trouble for this now. This would be a total disaster. I'm going to miss work tomorrow night. I was totally deferring over this. And then I'm walking down the street, and I realize everyone's, like, swigging stuff out of bottles. Like, they don't. There's no law against it, first of all. And second of all, it's, like, encouraged. Like, they'll just go drink this in the street. Like, get out there. Go get them, Tiger.
It's certainly encouraged because every single, like, restaurant and bar that we passed, like, the signs on the outside would say, like, cocktails to go. Yeah. Like, which I thought was the coolest thing ever. Like, take your drink. Yeah, you could pretty. I don't think drinking and driving is cool in Louisiana, but definitely drinking and walking is encouraged. Highly encouraged.
Stumbling.
They have drive through cocktails there where you get, like, you drive through in your car and you get a cocktail with a lid on it with a straw taped to it. And apparently the way to get around the law is you get two straws. You get the lid with the straw taped on top of it, and then you get another straw. And you peel the lid back, drink it out of the straw, and if you get pulled over, you get rid of the other straw, push the lid back down, and say, see, closed up. and then you're fine. That's how you get around the law.
That's like, impenetrable.
They petitioned. They had to like petition to get this legal where you could have drive-through cocktails in Louisiana because they said the way they got it passed was they sat down with like whatever the law enforcement officials were, gave them a can of beer and a to-go cocktail, and figured out that it took this is all they needed. Figured out it took longer to open the to-go cocktail than a can of beer, so it's cool.
Things really are different there.
Yeah, no, they really are. It's totally different. It's insane. And I remember, like, the drive from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, if you've ever done it, you're, like, basically on a bridge for, like, an hour just going through the swamp, like, the highway, and even, like, a big interchange, just all built on the water. And I was just driving through there being, like, people weren't supposed to live here. Like, this was not meant for living. Like, New Orleans, when you stand in New Orleans, you stand in the French Quarter and realize, like, the river is above you, like, above your feet. And there's, like, all these huge, like, locks and gates that, like, swing closed to, like, try and keep everything from flooding. Like, this is not supposed to be here. Like, what are you doing? Why did you build this?
It's a very different city, I'll say that. I found the city very gimmicky. Like, it's just a big joke. Like, there's nothing really, like, there's a lot of character about it, but there's just, I don't know, it's become a parody of itself at this point. Like, it's like a character on a show who, like, eventually just gets so ridiculous that they're just doing what they're supposed to be doing because everyone else's perception of them. That's how I think of New Orleans.
It's the Kramer of cities.
Yeah, exactly.
There are some parts of New Orleans that are not a joke at all. We luckily did not come in contact with them. Last time we went, 2007, our writer Nick Zaccardi, his car overheated, and we had to pull off in a particularly unsavory part of New Orleans. We were at a meat shop / car repair place.
/
Yeah, Wagner's Meat, you can't beat our meat, was their slogan. And,
of course
we got really lucky. The mechanic, like, fixed his car for free, basically, because it was something stupid.
Gave y'all, like, a free primer.
We were really uneasy. And there's still, like, a lot of things going on. Like, there's still, like, a lot of gutted apartments and, like, stuff that hasn't come back since Katrina. The Six Flags theme park, you can see from the interstate, is... actually about to get bought. I just found this out. They decided not to reopen it. They're going to reopen it as a Nickelodeon theme amusement park. It's going to be awesome.
Nickelodeon's still around? I didn't know that.
Apparently Nickelodeon is still around.
Here's the moment that sums up our weekend in New Orleans, for me at least. We were walking to dinner in the French Quarter, and we saw this guy.
We're on Bourbon Street.
We saw this guy painted in all silver and dressed like a clown riding a bike. And no one batted an eye.
It was a jester.
It was a jester. All silver, like some kind of street performer, just like casually riding his bike down the street, and it was like normal.
Yeah, it was completely ridiculous. Also, Bourbon Street is completely ridiculous. Like, the concept of Bourbon Street is just really weird. It's like an entire street pretty much closed down. Like, the cars drive through the intersections, which is stupid, like going the other way, going against the grain. But, like, there's just a horde of people. It's essentially one big party, like, one big kegger, but with, like, 1,000 kegs. Like, there's just drinks everywhere, and you're just walking up and down, and, like, no one's really doing anything. You're just all there to get drunk, and the whole thing was just really weird.
Yeah, it was pretty insane. Bourbon Street was crazy, but it wasn't, like... I thought, like, from what I heard about it, that I would feel, like, a little, like, uncomfortable or, like, unsafe there, but I didn't at all. I was, like, totally, like... It was, like, fun, I thought.
Well, I don't think any of the locals go to Bourbon Street. I think they all know it's ridiculous and it's a big joke. Like, I'd say it was at least 75% people from Florida.
Yeah.
It was just all people from Florida. We had said the over-under at the beginning of the night of how many people we'd bump into that we knew from back home, and, like, it was way over that. Like, everyone was seeing people they knew. Like, it was like Gainesville West for that period of time. So, I don't know. It was kind of interesting.
I was going to say, back here in Gainesville, I felt empty. Like, there was nobody here. It's like, oh, everybody's in Baton Rouge, New Orleans. Yeah. Like, all the losers stay here in Gainesville like myself. So, all right, we're going to wrap the show up with our weekly awards, our Reggie Nelson Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport, and Kyle Jackson Bad Angles of the Week. We'll point out one good or bad thing we saw this last week. Let's start off with our Kyles. Let's start with Deefer.
All right, so we're walking down Bourbon Street in New Orleans enjoying ourselves when we walk across a baby. A man holding a baby.
Just on the street, all right?
So we come across a man, a drunk man, with a beer in one hand and a baby in the other hand.
Like a football.
Yeah, like a football, like T-bowing, like Heisman Trophy, holding the baby.
No one else holds football. Yeah.
And that's when we knew New Orleans was a different place. Now, this is, you think one baby would be enough, right?
No.
We saw multiple babies.
Just one more.
We saw several babies. We saw another baby. Now,
this is the most embellished story of all time. I also don't think there was a beer in the other hand.
No, there was.
All right. It makes for a better story.
I didn't get a good look. I just saw him T-bowing the baby. Right, which would be more towards circumcision than
holding. Any parent who thinks it's okay to bring their baby to Bourbon Street is a horrible parent and shouldn't be allowed to have children. That's it.
Yeah, the woman carrying one was like an infant. Like, what on earth?
We also saw some like small, not babies, but like smaller children, like 5-6 years old. And I think that's even worse. Because those children know what's going on. The baby, it's like horrible and a bad atmosphere, but it's not going to remember.
I didn't see. They were like little kids.
Bob told me about it. Bob pointed out.
Oh, they're in his sight line.
It was Bob, yeah. They tried to play with Bob.
Who brings their children to Bourbon Street to get like drunk? Like, at least when you're around everyone that is drunk.
I don't think they brought the kids to get drunk.
I didn't mean.
He meant while they get
drunk. I didn't mean the children were drinking.
They could have been. We also saw like the best homeless dance that I think.
I totally forgot.
We saw. Okay, so there are these two like pretty drunk girls dancing on the sidewalk in front of a bar, and there's this like really haggard looking homeless guy dancing behind them. Like the most, he was in a stupor.
So they keep it shuffle.
And then eventually, this one of our photographers was snapping it like at high like frames per second, so he pretty much got a video of it. And the guy ends up after the girls, I guess, kind of caught on and left. He danced around by himself a little bit, and then he just stumbled into a bar. Like, he just fell over.
Literally,
he fell over, and somebody had to come help him up. And then he got there was light applause. Like,
he fell backwards over the threshold of the bar. Like it was incredible.
I just like your shimmy impersonating the guy's dance. Shimmy.
He would have been flagged for excessive celebration had he been in an end zone.
My thing with bringing the kids to Bourbon Street, it's like if you don't have the time to like drop the kid off before you go drink, like if you're so busy drinking that you have to take the kid with, don't have a kid. Like you got other priorities. Clearly, don't worry about the kid. Just enjoy your drinking. Don't. Oh man, I can't even imagine that situation.
I hope the babies are in pictures of all them drinking. Like I hope someday they're gonna look back. Oh, that's me.
You hope that. That's good.
Only we don't live that long.
All right, I'll go ahead and give my Kyle. This is going to multiple people. It's a list. I'd say David Garrard, Brian Westbrook, D'Angelo Williams, Willis McGahee, Anquan Boldin, Bernard Berry, and Owen Daniels, the 49ers defense, and Prater for the Broncos.
Matt
Prater. That was my fantasy lineup this week. It bombed completely. I was 4-0, undefeated in my NFL fantasy league. Completely, it was a complete disaster. I scored like 30 points.
Oh, your NFL fantasy league, huh?
All right.
Not our fantasy
league. You don't get to complain about the 49ers defense because they got you 39 points the week before.
And -3.
You have no one to blame but yourself for putting a Jaguar on your fantasy team. I warned you against this. David Garrard is my boy. Under no circumstances should you play Jaguars on your fantasy team. Don't even play Maurice Jones-Drew.
Which I did.
If you have Maurice
Jones-Drew,
trade him because he plays for the Jaguars.
Just drop him.
Nothing good happens.
But I warned against me taking David Garrard. I assume you mean tried to outbid me, right?
Well, that wasn't my team either. That was just...
That was just selfish.
I was buying for someone else, and it was more like, if anyone's going to have David Garrard, I'm going to have David Garrard.
Yeah,
it was personal. On the bench. Yeah, it was very personal. That's why I threw down money to take whoever the next defense was.
Like the Dolphins defense away from me.
David Garrard's played great this year, by the way.
Until he had a great week last week. I started him over Eli Manning.
Last week's the only week he was like a great fantasy player, though. Like before that, it hasn't been like they're not going to air it out because they don't have receivers. They still don't have great blocking. They're not getting the running game going because they don't have great blocking. Like there's no reason to play any Jaguars. It really isn't.
I mean,
if you can hit the one week out of five where they play well, great, and more power to you. But
I'm not going to place all the blame on Garrard because the rest of the team was awful as well.
I'm not blaming Garrard. I'm just saying you shouldn't play him in fantasy.
Yeah. All right,
it's your fault, not Garrard's.
You should give it to yourself.
All right, sure. I already gave myself one like last week, I think. I can't hate on myself that much.
All right. My Kyle Jackson's fairly involved. He goes to, I guess, a lot of LSU staffers who are in charge of, like, running the game. And started off when we had to go park. All of our parking passes were different for the two cars. We had a completely different lot than Phil's. We followed Phil into his lot, at which point they told us we had to go to our lot, which was lot O. But over at lot T, they had people, like, flagging you in, like, hey, go park here, like, directing you into, like, the many open spots. We drive all the way around the stadium, which took us probably 30 to 35 minutes because the traffic was absolutely insane and we accidentally, like, got caught when the team buses were coming in. So by the time we get there, like, they tell us to come in. I'm like, where do I need to go to park? They're like, well, just find a spot. And, of course, all the spots are, like, filled. There are people tailgating. Like, spots are overrun, just taken up with, like, grills and chairs. Like, there's no cars in the spot. So, after driving around the parking lot for about 20 minutes, we finally get one. So, we count our blessings, get out, walk towards the stadium. Then we have to pick up our credentials at media will call. which took us a while to find. But once we got there, Bobby got his just fine, and then I had to get mine, and there was no credential for me there. So the guy's pretty much just, like, giving me a hard time the whole time, like, oh, who do you work for? What's your name? I'm like, just give me a second, man. I'm gonna call Ben. The other guy works for the post, so he would know what was going on. I call Ben. He said that they didn't mail him his credential and that there's a seat up in the press box with my name on it. Like, it doesn't just say Palm Beach Post. It's Kyle Maestri on the seat up in the press box. I relay that to the guy standing at the booth. He again gives me, like, the, well, I don't know, man. Like, what happened to the Kyle community? Gives me the whole shakedown. He calls whoever he needs to call up there. Finally, he writes my name on a temp pass, and he's like, you need to go see this guy when you get up there, but he's not buying your story right now. I'm like, what? So, and it turns out when I got up there, the guy was really nice to me. So that was step two. Step three, the finishing blow, was after the game. I was just trying to walk back from interviews across the field, go back up into the press box, and game day was shooting on the field. So I walked back at about the 30. They were, like, on the other side of the end zone. Some dude with, like, this brown jacket ran up to me and was like, get off the field, get off the field, just, like, screaming at me to get off the field. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. So he's like, walk past this trooper, which is on the 45-yard line. I'm like, okay. Trooper clears me. I walk across. And as I get to the other end of the sideline, I'm about to get back into the press box, somebody else just hounds me again, like, oh, the guy with the jacket told you not to cross the field, but you just did it anyway. You just did it anyway, huh? You couldn't help yourself. I'm like, are you kidding me? The police officer told me it was fine. So the moral of the story is, the LSU atmosphere is awesome, unless you're a journalist.
Yeah, me and the guy I worked for got yelled at the entire way to the stadium that we were tiger bait. And this plays into the last time I went, when I saw, like, innocent fans getting beer poured on them and stuff for wearing Florida shirts. Like, those people are just, like, my theory that you never get out of Louisiana, so you don't experience other culture, and you just hate everything else. I'm going to stick with that. And, yeah, in 2007, like, the key to the people that work around Tiger Stadiums, they don't know anything. Like, you ask them a question, they don't know. I don't know. I don't know where Press Will Call is. I don't know where the elevator shaft up to the press box and all the luxury suites is. I don't know what gate you're supposed to go in. I don't know where your parking lot is. I don't know which road you need to take to get over there. I don't know. That's all you hear is, I don't know. And I got yelled at for walking diagonally across the field instead of straight across the field. I like to see them go yell at some football players for running diagonally across the field in their cleats. When we went in 2007, they sent us on the wrong side of the stadium, and we had to get escorted across the field, which was pretty cool, to get over to the side of the press box. And then this time, they don't know where the press gate is, even though it's two gates down, with a huge-ass sign that says press gate on it, but they couldn't figure that out. We had to figure it out ourselves. Total joke. And then my Kyle's also going to go to, I don't know who deserves the blame for this. I guess it's someone in the press box staff. This happened twice in a row. They bring up mini pizzas from Papa John's at the end of the game. Look, all right? They bring up mini pizzas for the media at the end of the game. They're supposed to bring us some kind of food. That's great. I'm really excited about mini pizza because the other food was not really that great. So
I enjoyed the other food.
It was all right. It was like one of those buffet things. The meat was a little questionable.
Wah.
The vegetables were great. I really enjoyed the vegetables. So anyway, they bring up these mini pizzas, and the same thing happened in 2007, where we go down and do interviews as they're bringing up the pizza, and then we get back up there and the pizza's gone. And I don't know if they have, like, a pack of raccoons and wild dogs running through the press box eating this pizza.
Likely.
They have, like,
yeah, definitely raccoons.
Like, there's, like, support staff from the stadium creeping up into the press box to take it all. It drives me insane. Just save the pizza until everyone gets back from doing their media work so we can eat.
I hear the Pouncey's got to it.
So then the light at the end of the tunnel for me is that in 2007, they wheeled up this enormous cooler full of beer and just flipped it open and said, have at it, guys, which is unprecedented. And so I'm like, oh, well, that'll be nice at least. Because you sit there and you look out the back of the stadium and all you see are brake lights. Like, just everybody stopped. It's like a parking lot on all the streets leaving. So you know you're not going anywhere for a while. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll bring up the cooler full of beer, which they had already said they would, and it didn't come. So that was awful. Just really ruined the whole night for me. No mini pizza, no free beer.
All right. The only thing I need, really.
Yeah. It's all you wanted on the trip to Baton Rouge, and you didn't get it. All right, well, I'll start with my Reggie. I'm going to give it to Army. This runs deep.
God damn it.
Because Thursday night, I believe it was, Kyle, you, me, and Phil picked five teams that we thought would win this weekend.
I did the same thing with Deeper and Bobby and had almost all the same teams.
Really?
So you know how that one went. Okay.
Yeah, I went in a surprising 5-0. Everybody, we were, you know, you guys were mocking my picks as I was making them. South Carolina. Pitt.
I liked both. I didn't like Pitt. I liked South Carolina, and I was mocking Phil, the hardest,
okay,
by
all
far.
Right. But Phil, you know, Phil saying, oh, all right, you're going to go 0-5. You know, not a good week for you. I went 5-0. Kyle, you went 4-1 thanks to Army beating Vanderbilt, which I believe you described as, like, impossible, never going to happen, right, something like that.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
If they played that game 99 times or 100 times, they win 99 of them.
But the Cadets came through with this one and got me the win in that. Phil, by the way, 3-2.
Did you watch the highlights? Do you know what happened?
No, I didn't see that.
In overtime, Army was about to score. They were knocking on the door. They fumbled the ball out of the back of the end zone.
Vanderbilt.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Was about to score, fumbled the ball out of the back of the end zone, and that's how they didn't score in overtime. So,
a win's a win. I'll take
Bobby Johnson. Very upset with you.
All right, let's go with D for you, Reggie.
All right, my Reggie Nelson this week is going to the game day crew, but particularly Desmond Howard, who we all saw after the game. We were walking back to the press box. Now you see the game day guys in their suits and stuff in front of the desk. You think they're all wearing suits, right? Wrong. They're wearing jean shorts. Desmond Howard's wearing jean shorts, and Chuck Taylor's underneath his suit top. So they're sitting there wearing Chuck Taylor's and jean shorts. I love it.
Like jorts?
No, like, I mean, they're, like, longer shorts. I don't know. Okay. I guess they're jorts, but
when I went on ESPN...
There's a double standard with jorts, by the way. Black people are allowed to wear jorts, but whites aren't for some reason.
When I went on ESPN a couple years ago, I had a long-sleeved dress shirt and then gym shorts on. It's the way to do it.
So this
so
is just accepted.
No, yeah.
TV,
I think,
right?
Like,
this is what happened.
Yeah, what's his name?
I was kind of shocked by this.
Yeah. You see what they need to see. Now, see, SportsCenter's gotten themselves in trouble now because they do the rotating camera thing now where you see behind them. Big mistake. They can't be as comfortable.
They have to stand in front of the screen every once in a while.
You want
to
go sweatpants.
It's like that SportsCenter commercial where they're doing it in their underwear. Like, that's real life. It's actually not a joke. It's a very serious assessment of the TV industry.
Think about the freedom with your wardrobe, though. You don't have to match like a blazer to pants. If you don't have the pants for it, you don't need the pants. You just wear the blazer because it's all they're going to see on TV.
That'd be funny if they didn't have any matching pants. It was just their closet. It's all blazers.
Blazers and gym shorts or something. All right, Kyle, go ahead and give out your
rating. Mine's short and sweet. I'm giving it to Hand Grenades. The drink was great. It was everything that I expected it to be and more. It didn't give me a hangover, which I'm also very appreciative of. But it's absolutely delicious. It's very gimmicky to go along with the city. It comes in shaped like a big hand grenade. But it was delicious. I enjoyed it. And it definitely outdid Hurricanes.
All right, McCall.
My Reggie goes to two eating experiences we had down in the French Quarter. On Friday night, we were wandering around looking for something to eat, having no luck. And we were approached by a very nice man named David Montrell on the sidewalk holding a menu and promising us 15% off our meal. We turned him down the first time. I believe there may have been promise of a crawfish appetizer. We turned him down because we were going to meet some other people, and then we found out they had no idea what was going on. So we ended up coming back to Montreal on our knees, begging. He gave us the 15% off still, no crawfish appetizer. And he treated us to the story of how Montreal's bistro came to be, which was apparently they were in the ghetto, and then after Katrina moved into the French Quarter. I don't know how that was quite a reversal of fortune from everyone else with Katrina. I guess maybe like a nice restaurant that had been there was washed out and they were like desperate for businesses to move in and he pounced. Montrell's was quite good. Me and Defer had the fried chicken. It was wonderful. So big ups to Montrell's. And then also we went to Café du Monde, which is the famous place that has the vignettes. And we were waiting in line, which was an enormous line, the takeout line for him, and we were kind of in a rush to get to Baton Rouge. And I was like, this is going to fail. This is going to be a really bad move. And we're standing in the back of the line, and this waiter just kind of comes up to us and goes, hey, what do you want? I'll go get it for you. And he did. He went and got it and paid him cash. Nice and easy. That might have saved 35 minutes.
Yeah, that was a great move, but it was definitely under the table, I think. Yeah. But whatever.
He's just pocketing it.
Also, a little advice out there. If you're ever going to make the trip from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, don't eat the beignets in your car on the way, because it's just it's a bag of powdered sugar with, like, the actual fried dough just in there like treasure, and you got to, like, fish it out. And Deeper and I are eating them in the front seat of my car, and it just turned into, like, a white Christmas in the Civic. Like, there's powder everywhere. Deeper and I are wearing dark clothes. We look like total clowns, but it was worth it. It was delicious, but, you know, just make sure you're not taking an hour drive on the way.
That would have been fun if you got pulled over and they found white powder all
over the recipe for disaster. All right, that wraps it up for this show. Send any feedback you have to podcast at alligator.org. We'll be back Friday with a preview of the homecoming game. Thanks for listening.